Welcome to the NMK podcast. NMK is a learning and business information hub for companies and individuals working in UK digital media and runs a year-round programme of courses, conferences and events. This was recorded at NMK's Content 2.0 conference on the 6th of June 2006. The session is Marketing 2.0 equals Content 2.0. A forum session featuring Jamie Kantrowitz of MySpace, Humor Cloud of Gaping Void, and James Chekhov of Collaborate Marketing, chaired by Michael Baylor of the Rights Marketing Company.
Hi, everybody. Now we're going to talk about that sticky subject of marketing in a 2.0 environment. First of all, I wanted to thank the people who spoke earlier, Mark and Adriana. That was really, really an interesting start. And both sessions really, I think, opened the minds of the audience for what's to come. I've been told, my name is Michael Baylor, by the way, I haven't been told that, I brought that to the event. And I've been told by our fearless leader, Zoe, that this is two things. First of all, it's the heart of the morning's discussion, which makes me feel very tense. And secondly, that we are hoping for lively debate. Now, when we say lively debate, I think what's meant by Zoe is not fistfights or anything of that nature. But there's a lot of really, really interesting pushing and pulling going on in the marketing environment as a direct result of what we laughingly call 2.0. I'd like to be the first person here to take personal ownership of 2.0. I want you to call me Michael 2.0 for the rest of the day, if that's okay. And let me just talk for a second about, because if we're going to talk about content 2.0, and I have to actually echo and support Adriana vigorously, with my own dislike for the word content. I think it sort of says everything and nothing. But we know that we're talking about marketing 2.0. I'd like to suggest that a useful way of looking at 2.0 for this discussion is the migration of value into pastures new. That's the locus of value, where value is to be found, the nature of value, what it is and what it looks like, and also how it gets created. And one of the things we know is that in Web 2.0, consumers are playing a more and more active role in deciding what value is, deciding when and how they want to have it. And sorry, I used the C word once there. I don't intend to use it again. From now on, can I suggest that we talk not about consumers, but about people? Because once a person is at the heart of value creation, in a sense, they cease to become a consumer. It's arguable that the companies they choose to deal with become consumers of that person's attention, perhaps. I'd like to also draw your minds back to this thing about attention. Adriana raised it, Mark touched on it. I think it's absolutely critical for this morning's discussion. Without attention, any marketing effort and any content, any online brand or offline brand or whatever, is a tree that falls in the woods and nobody hears it. Attention is absolutely critical, and one of the critical pieces of the value that's on the move in 2.0 is that attention is on the move and increasingly in full control of the consumer. This means that whether you're a rights owner in the entertainment or media zone, or whether you're a brand looking to somehow, communicate, build your customer base, and so on, it becomes increasingly difficult to reach people. And when it's difficult to reach people, everything falls apart. So marketing is facing enormous challenges in this space. So if we can just remember the V word. As a consultant, I've done a lot of consulting in this space. Whenever I use the word value in a corporate environment, everyone seems to react as if you just said the word fuck very loudly shortly after having met them. Value is a difficult term to work with, but let's just suspend judgment on that for the moment and just say we like the idea of it and let's just put it to one side. The other thing is, and I think it's worth looking at, there's been a lot of talk in sort of Harvard Business Review territory about the migration from product to services. We see another thing going on here, which is as value was added to products by creating services, so value is getting added to services, the next wave, by the creation of experiences. And this is one of the most interesting areas in 2.0. So what is there to say about marketing 2.0? I think we've got three people on the panel here. I exclude myself from that because I'm still a consumer, but we've got three persons on the panel here who are going to tell us some very interesting stuff. James, at the end, James Chekhov, is from a PR background and will be giving us, and it now advises corporations on the sticky task of engaging with comms in a 2.0 space. James is going to be talking to us about the issue of effective communication with the 2.0 consumer. Hugh, the ebullient Hugh, is probably more knowledgeable than anyone else, certainly in the front row and at the desk here, about how to engage at a retail level and how to build brands, how to build retail brands with consumers, particularly using techniques like blogging. Brand hostile techniques like blogging. Very, very difficult to do that. It's all about relevance, intrusion, interruption experience does not work well. Your brand is on parade. As Shell would say, your brand is naked, I think, in this space. So traditional marketing communication tools are to be used with great care in the 2.0 space. And finally, representing the sharp end of big media, I'm really, really happy to introduce Jamie, who is responsible for almost everything that seems to me to be important about MySpace in Europe and has what I think is probably the hottest seat in her office in marketing and media in the European domain. So I'm really looking forward to hearing what these people have to say. We also have a couple of extremely clever people in the audience, Justin and Nicholas, who have the great titles of distributed intelligence agents. Now, if I was to look for a job title on my business card, it's too late because I have one already. A distributed intelligence agent feels so 2.0, and it makes the previously exalted title of chairperson feel sort of lame and 1.0. So we have distributed intelligence agents in the audience, and I would be looking to them to jump in when we humble souls up here lose the plot. What I'd like to do right now, given that we've talked a little bit, building on Adriana's presentation, I'd like to ask Mr. Cherkov to kick us off with a few thoughts about what's happening with the communications with the 2.0 consumer. Are you all right with that, James?
Sure. Yeah, I'll give that a go. Yeah. Right, good morning. Can I ask who here reads blogs? Right. You don't have to put your hand up. Who here writes a blog or blogs? And who here has heard of Wikipedia? Uses Wikipedia? Contributes to Wikipedia? Great, okay, thanks. I spend my life going around brands talking to them about how to get to grips with all of this stuff. Always, the number one issue is control. Because, not to put too fine a point on it, all of this, to a lot of, marketeers, just seems like bloody anarchy. If you've come from a situation and you've built your business around the ideas of command of the media and control of the message for 40 or 50 years, if that then appears to be taken away from you, you get an overwhelm. Sometimes you get quite a strong sense of fear, in fact, within marketing and branding organisations. And marketing gets an awfully hard rap at the moment, and people are talking about it being dead or just useless. To my mind, that's not right, because marketing is just about markets. So this sort of simple street market through to mass markets, which now appear to be changing. So really we're just at the point whereby it's a very interesting time where things are changing apparently quite radically. And marketers know this. There is a sort of sense in some ways that marketers are just oblivious to all of this, they don't really care, and they're just ploughing on regardless. But the good ones do. Jim Stengel, who's the biggest marketeer in the world, he's the chief marketing officer of Procter & Gamble and spends $5 billion a year on marketing. It's come out of the quote of saying that the traditional model is obsolete. So the marketing industry is basically just trying to work out what's happening next. And I think the big problem is that there's a model which has worked very, very well for 40 or 50 years, but it's unclear where to go to next. So if you're a marketing officer, you're a marketing director of a large brand, it's no good for people to come in and sort of you know, shout everything must change if you're not too sure where the next step is. I think the actual, I mean, it was touched upon before, I think that the actual view that brands have had of themselves is that they are the supernovas, that they are massive in size, that they dominate media around the world. And I think that mindset is one that's currently being challenged. In fact, it seems that the very, very large consumer networks are, in fact, really maybe the new supernovas, with the brands floating around them. But once again, if you're a mega brand and you've spent years bestriding the globe, that's quite a difficult thing to take on board. An example of that is I saw Jimmy Wales, who set up Wikipedia, talk last year, and he said he was in conversation with the editor of the New York Times. And the editor of the New York Times was talking to him and describing to him all the problems that he thought Wikipedia was going to have further down the line when it grew. And then they compared traffic and they realised at that point in time, Wikipedia was 6 times larger than the New York Times. And that just changed the nature of the conversation, rather. One of the other difficult things that brands are trying to understand is that is measurement. If you're a professional marketeer, an awful lot of your job is about measuring the effects of things that you do, and that's very, very difficult to do in this new space. I think the figures I read recently, which is one of those figures which is probably wrong, but it sounds like it might be about right, is that there are currently 3 trillion web pages on the web, and that's growing at 25,000 pages every hour. So it's almost untrackable. It's almost unknowable. And that really strikes fear into the heart of marketeers. The other area that I talk to people about, and it can be very confusing for brands, and is about this idea of user-generated content, which is one of the exact, you know, people like it. It kind of says what it is, however. And the thing, if you have, for brands, it can often appear that that content is worthless because it's unmeasurable. And there's often the idea that, in fact, it's the people creating the content are nutters. Or in their bedroom alone, wearing their pyjamas, drinking hot coffee and writing about their love of their cats, which is probably not a bad way to spend most mornings, in fact. But it's very difficult for a brand to understand how that could be of any value or any significance. Unless, of course, they're talking about the brand in question. And it becomes hugely significant. But these are some of the issues that brands are really just trying to understand and get their heads around, and I'm no doubt they will. The other part of the other issue I just want to touch upon is that this term social software, to my mind, it seems we've now moved on a stage where it's less about the software and more about the social. So we're now really starting to appreciate, I think, that social software is just software that allows people to be social. So it may sound quite obvious, but I've talked to brands and they say, well, you know, people are out there chatting and it just all looks like rubbish. So why should we really be interested? And or they say, how can we control that conversation? Uh-huh. So you end up in these slightly bizarre situations. And really, I mean, it's like control. It's like going into a farmer's market in London, which we probably all have in our neighbourhood. And it's like trying to go in there and trying to capture the conversation in there or measure the conversation in there or in a pub. I mean, people aren't really. It's the actual act of socialising around that conversation. I certainly know when I go to the pub with my friends, I try and talk as much sense as possible, but we're really there just enjoying ourselves. And that's what a lot of the networks, you know, be they distributed, like, you know, the blogging networks, or be they massive networks like MySpace, people are really just enjoying themselves. So for a band to go in there and try and measure that becomes, especially if you're committed to try and using the old tools to measure this new space, that becomes very difficult. I think a good example of that is actually Nike have created a new community. Is there anyone here from Nike? Who here has come across the massive Nike community? Is it jogger or yoga or one of the two? Yeah. And it's a very, very large community based around football, just in coming up to the World Cup, obviously. So you can go on there, you can create a profile, and you can talk about any subject you wish. You can talk about whatever you want to do with to do with the football. You can talk about your team, and you can choose any players to create your own World Cup, as long as they're Nike players. So they have this wonderful advertising campaign, and they're on the billboards. I'm a very big Arsenal fan. They have all the billboards around the UK. Very large, you know, ad spend with Eric Cantona. And they've drawn a huge number of people into this space. And it's about the freedom of football. It's about the expression of football, as long as it's Nike football. So that's quite a good example of the problems that brands are facing, because obviously they already have certain IP issues in place. Do they really want to allow consumers to start talking about competitors, players? And I'm sure all this stuff will be worked out, but I suppose I would just end by saying at the moment, it's very confusing for the marketing industry.
Could you talk to us about your sharp end experiences, or dare I use the phrase marketing tool, of blogs as marketing tools? I know you've got some direct experience of that. In response to James and building on James's point, can you give us some direct experience in terms of the problems that he's raised?
Okay. Since I started blogging, besides my own blog, I've marketed, got known for marketing two main products. One is a Savile Row tailor called Thomas Mahon, who used to cut for the Prince of Wales, and used to cut for Alec Guinness and Fred Astaire and these people. And another one was, he sells $4,000 suits. And the other one was a small winery in South Africa called Stormhook. And they both were very different, because one is one guy with a $4,000 or 2,000 pound product, and the other one is a winery that makes tens of thousands of cases a year. And how do we use social blogging to increase, shall we say, the sales and all that of, for want of a better word, a mass market product? Now, in retrospect, the tailor was a no-brainer. Just talk about what you know, talk about what you love, share your enthusiasm, and people will discover you. And that's exactly what happened, to the point where it basically tripled his business inside 6 months. And he got in the New York Times within like 3 months, and he got a guy interviewing for a book within about 4 months. I can't remember the name of the book. and all this, if you Google Savile Row now, he's number one. And to make a long story short, that was great. The one thing I told him when he first started blogging was, to use the old Clutrainism, you don't control the conversation. And all brands, if you're smart, you realize this. People talk about what they want to talk about. They don't talk about what you want to talk about. And when I think of control the conversation, recently I was consulting on a film blog. These guys are making a film, and the parent company of the production company is Disney. So one of the first questions I was asked was, okay, we write a blog, and then we upload photographs. how do we keep people from copying it? What do you mean? Well, we don't want people like cutting and pasting this stuff to cop and putting it on their own internet. Why not? It's almost the thing about Hollywood is they're so locked into lawyers and copyright that they can't imagine a world where the Creative Commons can exist. So anyways, I was talking to Thomas, and I said, write about tailoring, write about why the pinstripes don't match at the shoulder seam, which is a very interesting reason why. Write about how to sew on buttons. I mean, this guy's one of the top 10 tailors in the world. Just talk about write about tailoring at that level, what it implies. But you don't control the conversation. If you don't control it, how do you get a good outcome from that? And I've figured it out. You control the conversation by improving the conversation. You go in there and you raise the nature of interaction, then people are going to pay attention to you. If you lower the level of interaction, they're going to ignore you. It doesn't matter whether you're a humble tailor or whether you're Coca-Cola. You're too easy to ignore in this space, and you're too easy to take the piss out of, and you're too easy. And the bigger you are, the more the vulture is going to gather every time you trip. The thing about blogs is four things. The thing about blogs is, A, they're cheap. Secondly, they're easy. How many people here are in marketing professionally in some kind of capacity? Okay, all right. Well, the thing is about marketing, how many people in advertising and how many people are in journalism? Okay, so we got some marketing, advertising, journalism type people here. The thing is, you guys, me, we're not in the cheap and easy business. We want to sell stuff that's expensive and difficult. Because the harder it is, the more expensive it is, the more money we make, and the less other people can copy us. And we like that. So really, blogs really aren't that interesting to us because we're not in the cheap and easy model. And I think that's what's making us uncomfortable. The second thing is they're linked. So in other words, they all link to each other. That means we can talk about you more so. Other people can find out what other people are saying about you, so it doesn't matter what spin you're putting on it, the truth will out. Fourthly, and this is what makes people uncomfortable, I think, is I think what drives the blogosphere, at least what drives the most interesting part of the blogosphere, is not ambition and profit. And we professionals are all pretty ambitious and we like money, or else, we wouldn't be professionals. We'd go work in a candle shop. And I think what makes the blogosphere interesting is people do it for love and goodwill. I think people love the people they connect to. They bond with the people they connect to. It's important stuff. And I think if you're not sharing what you love, if you have no love, if you're just doing it to take, you're just going there to take and not to give in a very human way, then people are going to ignore you again. So I think stick to advertising. It's not as useful as it was. It's not as cheap as it was. But hey, at least you have metrics to measure it with, and maybe that way you can protect your job. Okay, the second project I did was a winery called Stormhook, which is a small winery. And they got 250 acres, and they wanted to market their wine, and they're Jason, the guy who hired me, is fascinated by all this blog stuff, and he said, "Can you advertise? Maybe we could blog about our wine and advertise it." He says, "Well, yeah, you could do that, but no one's going to read it because you're just talking about yourself. Why should that be interesting?" And then we had the idea. Well, what we could do is we could maybe get people to try it, maybe get bloggers to try it, and we could send it out, see what people think. And that was good. We sent out 100 bottles, and people blogged about it. Not everybody liked it. But it was kind of interesting for us just to start the conversation, start the ball rolling. Now, what was interesting to me about this, and this is the most insightful thing I found out about blogging as a marketing tool is it's not what happens to the people out there that matters, because only a few thousand people are going to see your blog. What is interesting to me is how it changes the internal organization, how it actually affects your company. There's a guy that Shell knows called Robert Scoble, who's the chief blogger or the best known blogger at.
I know him.
You know him too, yeah. Yeah, how well do you know him? I mean, let's not go there. And the thing about Robert is the way he has a very insightful and accessible nature. He doesn't sell any more Dell computers. He doesn't sell any more Toshiba. He doesn't raise the stock price directly. But what he does is he finds interesting conversations about Microsoft and engages in them. And that causes what I call an internal disruption that either works for you or doesn't work for you. And that's kind of what happened to Stormhook. All of a sudden, it wasn't that we were promoting the wine in a blogosphere, and all of a sudden everyone was reading blogs and finding about Stormhook and then going off to Threshers and buying copious amounts of alcohol. What happened was it shook people inside the industry, started talking about us, saying, what the hell are these guys doing? They're crazy. Who are these people? I've never heard of them. Who the hell are they? Who do they think they are, thinking they can go around doing all this? And the more that happened, and when your industry starts talking about you, it's only a matter of time before the buyers start talking. It's only a matter of time before the buyers start talking about you. And if they're talking about you, then when you walk into that office with a sales pitch, you're holding your head a little bit higher than you would have been. And that has an increased effect on sales. A guy at MIT, Dr. Pentland, said up to about 40% increase. Since we started blogging, Stormhook sales have doubled. I'm not going to say it's because of blogging. I'm just going to say, since we started taking this attitude, things have been good. So my coming out of this, as a marketer, I think blogs are incredibly disruptive to the cultural DNA. And if anybody wants to find out how, go find out who Robert Scoble is, find his blog and read it every day for a month, and maybe you'll understand why. But they're very disruptive. They change you. They change your DNA. They change your cultural DNA inside the organization. So if you're thinking about engaging in social media, I would start with the question, what are you actually trying to disrupt? What are you actually trying to change? Because what happens, I find, I go to a lot of these conferences, you know, people come up to me and say, I'm a junior brand manager. How can blogs make my job easier? And sometimes it's like, who says it's going to make it easier? It might put you out of business. You don't know. The thing that made Stormhook successful, and the thing that makes what Robert's doing over at Microsoft so successful, is there's a deep, inherent, genuine desire to change the way the business is run. And without that, blogs don't work.
Wonderful. The phrase brand truth popped into my head just at the end while you were talking there. It struck me that
Thomas the Tailor said a wonderful thing when the blog was taking off. He said, "So great, I don't have to do all this marketing rubbish. I just tell the truth, and the brand builds itself."
Yeah, or not? Yeah, absolutely. So what we heard from Hugh's very succinct and sharp end thing there, and we're going to come to Jamie in a second, which I'm looking forward to, is that blogs as an advertising tool are pretty questionable. In fact, possibly chalk and cheese. What's interesting is the collaboration that's facilitated between brand and customer and the change that has on the creation of value.
Yeah, I agree.
Let's get back to control, and let's go to Jamie.
Hi, everyone.
Hello.
I'm big media, but I was like really small media until about 3 months ago. So in listening to both of you, I mean, I think that I would just kind of add on all of the thoughtfulness that you had. I think what's interesting about MySpace, to put in context to what both of my prior spokespeople were saying, is that MySpace is now this large network of over 80 million people who are, like, reflecting both of the things that they're talking about, and especially in discussing how brands are inserted into a network and what it means when you can physically watch a dialogue start when your brand is sort of put into a platform that has all of these communications tools that are, you know, living outside of the traditional marketing environment. And just to add on what they were saying, you know, obviously what Web 2.0 and blogging and community sites like MySpace and all of these different communication mechanisms has done is it's sort of changed segmented marketing, so you're not really marketing at your consumers anymore, you're marketing with your consumers. And in one way where I think we find that we interact with a lot of marketers who want to put their brands on MySpace and they say, oh, you know, we don't want it to be out of our control and all of these things, there's a lot of positives and efficiencies with putting your brand, I think, into the social network. And one of them, I think, that's most important is that you now have, like, your medium is in your message. So it's the first place wherever, you know, communication and media has now just become one thing. And it creates an incredibly intimate dialogue with your consumer versus a marketing at them. You're sort of dialoguing with them. And I also would add that I think there's a lot of discussion about, oh, this is such a new frontier and all of these things. I think what's new about it is that it's something that you can now really visually see, and you can watch this really powerful dialogue and digital word of mouth, especially on a place like MySpace where you can literally watch your brand community grow as people discover it. And that can be a little bit harrowing, I think, to brands. But at the same time, I don't really think that it's anything that new. When you talk about, I think there's two aspects of that. One is the whole question of brands being nervous to put their, you know, their message around user-generated content. But television has been facing that challenge for, you know, many, many years, and brands, you know, saying, well, I don't want my commercial to be right next to this show, and I want it to be in the middle. And, you know, there's been that constant dialogue. So I don't think that that's anything that's very new. And then going back to your Nike analogy, and I think Nike is such a great sort of, you know, 2.0 marketing brand on many levels, not just because they created such a great community and they have such an amazing, like, emotional connection with their brand, but also Nike ID is so smart. And really what it's done is it's done a lot of things that are reflected in what's happening in technology, which is basically just, you know, consumers everywhere are living in a customized environment. You know, they have MySpace and they have blogs and they have TiVos and they have iPods, and, you know, they can absolutely create their media experience to whatever they want, and Nike has reflected that so well in a brand. But Nike, for example, is not going to tell you that your purple pants don't match with your, you know, red trainers that you just put on your feet. So on some level, I think brands have been letting go of control forever. It's just that it's a whole kind of new frontier that they're doing it in. So I think the one thing, especially about MySpace in addressing control issues with brands, and one thing that we do is work very closely with our marketers who want to put their brands into the network, because it is true that in discussing what you were talking about, you really want to improve the dialogue. Like, the reality is that everything that happens in every other part of your traditional marketing and all of the other traditional mediums is verified on the internet now. Yeah. So, you know, everybody's, you watch something on TV, they go to Google to search it, or you see a video, you check it on YouTube. If you love the OC and you're a user of MySpace, you're going to check out where the OC is on MySpace. So if you know that you're doing a great job in your brand marketing anyway, you have to kind of accept the reality that there is this whole other medium and your brand is being verified there on one of many platforms in a dialogue. So you can either choose to engage in that and improve the conversation, or you can just let it totally run free, because the reality is that it's happening, and it's happening faster than I think anybody expected. I mean, certainly, I would say the growth of MySpace reflects how fast.
May I interrupt?
Yeah.
I just wanted to say, when I talk about conversation, or she talks about conversation, not all conversation is verbal. For instance, the Tiffany blue box improves the conversation of jewelry. The Nike commercial improves, from the 90s, the Just Do It campaign improved the conversation of what sneakers are. The Volkswagen campaign from the 60s improved the conversation of what being a car is. So don't think you can't improve the conversation except on social media space. There's, you can prove it in any media you want to. You just have to take the moral decision to do so.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that when you start to think about putting your brand in a place like MySpace or in a blog or any other networking element, you have to just think about who those consumers are. So you have, you know, a little bit more of an elusive consumer. They're much more jaded by marketing. They know they're being marketed at, and they kind of want either an emotional connection. Oftentimes, you know, dare we say they want to be connected to, you know, entertainment and media. You know, there's always the big, you see tons of brands having marketing strategies now that connect them through film and music and things that people consume in their everyday life from an entertainment perspective. And I think that it's, you know, marketing entertainment online and creating those dialogues isn't obvious because you have things like iTunes and YouTube, and obviously people love to engage in entertainment. But then you have brands like, you know, a fast food chain, and you wonder, well, can I insert that brand into a blogging community or into a MySpace? And it's just a great example of a brand that I think did that really well. There's a fast food chain in the States called Wendy's, and they're really famous for a square hamburger. And they came to us and they said, well, you know, how would we actually put this onto a social network full of young people who, you know, could reject us, you know, or would it would seem too commercial or whatnot. And they made a character out of the square hamburger, and it's really funny. And it was just one of those things, like, just do it. I mean, it was merely just a little bit of creative energy that came from the agency, and they put a lot of irreverence into this square patty, and the community has over 150,000 people in it. And each of those people then become your own, you know, powerful digital word of mouth. I mean, I think the thing to remember is, say, don't worry about losing control. If you can improve the dialogue, which is exactly...
I got a question for you.
Sure.
Well, if you only have like 150,000 people interacting with this idea, well, that doesn't sound like a lot. But I'm assuming what they're going to take what they've learned from the experience with you guys and scale it out into TV characters and print advertising. So it's a great place to start a snowball rolling.
I definitely think so. I mean, you can look at it from two perspectives. You can look at a...
It's a bit off topic, but then again, no, it isn't. You have this enormously huge young community. And what is really most interesting to me about MySpace is what happens to this community as they age. Is your vision that you contain this community as they get older, or do you continuously get to the new, to the younger, hipper user? But you're becoming the starting point for a world that where the participants are more comfortable with social media than with traditional media. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering what MySpace is going to do about that moving forward.
That's a little off topic, but I can change the subject as well.
Yeah, let's go with
that. Well, I mean, I'll answer that in two parts. I think there's a misconception about how many teenagers are on MySpace versus how many people are in their 20s and 30s. MySpace has an incredibly powerful amount of people who are actually over the age of, you know, 20 years old. I think it's identified in the media as a teen phenomenon because people identify social networking and people who feel as though they're more comfortable putting their lives online, people who have grown up.
Just to clarify, because of my age, young people is under 30, not under 10.
Well said, Cheryl.
Well, okay, I can change that. But really, our core demographic is actually 16 to 34. I mean, we don't actually we can segment our community. We have a core base of users who, I think from an identity perspective, from a sociological perspective, have a different connection with MySpace. And I would say those people are probably more like 15 to 24. They use it differently. They are much more savvy. They really put their lives online. But I think one thing about MySpace that takes it out of it being a trend versus you know, having to immediately capture new consumers, which, by the way, every brand wants to do. You always want to bring younger people onto the site and capture them early, and hopefully that they grow up with you. But I think the thing about MySpace is it's not really that much different than saying I'm going to customize a Yahoo page, and I invest a lot of time into building my community. The only difference is that, you know, MySpace's platform is something that's based on all Web 2.0 communications tools, and Yahoo's platform is something that's based on a lot of version 1 with, you know, additional 2.0 that they're now circling back and trying to say, we want a social network, you know, we have blogging, we have communities. So I think MySpace is really a place where people put their lives online. They spend a lot of time investing in it, and they spend a lot of time there because it's the place where they go and go onto the internet. So as far as how we want to continue to capture consumers, the thing about MySpace that we've always stuck to is the only people who tell us to develop new products on our site are the consumers. You know, we have a huge dialogue with our consumer base. Tom, who's our president, becomes everyone's friend, and thousands of people write to him every day about what they want to see on MySpace. And that's kind of how we guide how we continually evolve the site. So we hope in that that will retain the users that we have, and that ultimately we will always be on the forefront of new tools and technologies that people want to communicate with that will add to the site, that will remain attractive to new consumers as they, you know, grow and come onto the internet.
Okay. How many people interface regularly with decision makers in big brands? And how many of them are happy? Right. Does anyone know about the, the advertising value in social media space? Anybody got some numbers on that? Last time I looked, it was actually very low in relation to the amount of consumer value that was undoubtedly being created and the number of people on there. But the advertising revenues are still extremely slight. Am I right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right, okay. I just want to get a reality check here because this is turning into a social network kind of evangelizing session here, and I'd like to stop that right away because we are actually here to talk about global marketing, and I really get what's happening with MySpace, and I'm really excited about it, and I really get the fact that collaboration between brand and customer facilitated by blogs and perhaps podcasts is... You have a point with respect to this, Sam? Let me just finish and we'll come to you. Can we get some microphones out here now that the social piece is waking up? Okay, great. So I just want to make the point that can we come back down to earth, and I'd like to hear a little bit more now from people who are dealing with mainstream brands and what their feeling is as they take understandably cautious steps into social networking. Why are they not spending more money on advertising, aside from the very obvious point that James raised originally, which is the lack of control? Sam?
The question really is, as MySpace does try to add marketing around its user base and amortize it. Mm-hmm. I think Lex has showed a whether you call it a seasonal dip or a significant dip in MySpace's page impressions last month. Is that related to the fact that you are now not abusing but starting to use that community to market value from them without paying them some value back? Are they leaving you because of it?
Well, I guess the one thing I'll address is our page impressions didn't decrease last month.
I think, So is Alexa wrong?
Well, there's 10 reasons. I mean, let's
step back from the stats here and get to the spirit of Sam's question,
is there a
value issue here that's starting to come up? Yeah, is that
yeah, I mean, I think that there is. Look, it's a really new industry, and MySpace, because it's the biggest entity of it, is certainly the interesting one to talk about. But to your point, yes, it's still a really burgeoning industry, and it's one that people are discovering and addressing and working with, you know, continually. We have not lost advertisers. Our company is still growing. So what I'll do is address what I know from internal perspective of our company versus what I read about my company in the press sometimes. I think that there are definitely dialogues always going on, that this is a challenge, and I would never sit up here and say that we don't sit with our marketers all the time and say, okay, we recognize that you are stepping into new territory and that it can be scary, but at the same time, there is a reality that it's going to happen with or without you. So that being said, what can we create that's compelling that will make people want to interact with you? And there are ways, I mean, if you want to step out of it and you want to talk particularly about MySpace, there are ways on MySpace to market that's not sticking your brand right on a user profile as well. So there's a lot of options when you start marketing in a user-generated content environment. You don't necessarily have to create something that really lets your brand go. Some marketers want to. You can connect your brand to an aspect of a social networking platform or a website similar to any type of portal, I would say. You know, we have advertisers who prefer to market within the walled gardens of our content channels, and that's something that we're very helpful in helping them do. We have other advertisers who say, we're looking for something that just, you know, connects us to something more creative, and it may not have to do with our brand in particular. We just want the brand association, and they want to do something in photography or viral elements or music streaming or... And so we really sit and try and figure out what that is to kind of create something compelling around it. Yes, you can monitor your communities. You can have more control over them. We help do that when the advertiser requests that. So I think that, you know, yes, there's going to be some skepticism because we are such a new platform, not just MySpace, but all of the networks and all of the user-generated content websites. I mean, I think almost to your question is going to watch like a YouTube. And how is YouTube, knowing that it's even a more unregulated environment? I mean, remember, MySpace is actually kind of a dinosaur at this point. I mean, we take a lot of steps in safety and security and monitoring content and all of these things, and you have these new frontiers that brands are showing up on, and that's kind of even more of an interesting question to see how marketers go.
Before we go to Justin, who I'm very interested to hear what he's got to say on this point, can I also raise the point there's a huge amount of brand-related activity going on in the MySpace environment that has nothing to do with advertisers. There's a huge amount of brand-related conversations, some positive, some negative, all immensely important, to go back to Hugh's point, in terms of the brand actually understanding what consumers want and how people feel about them. Can we get a microphone to my good friend Justin down here? I'm very interested in his point.
This is more of a random point, but... I guess Deirdre wanted me to speak because they wanted a bit of controversy, and the last NMK event I was at, someone called me a wanker, so so I'll start.
But are you a wanker?
Or should someone call Justin a wanker just to get that over and done with,
right.
and then he can speak freely?
It's just my wife was upset. she didn't know.
You can't stand the heat.
Basically, I'm going to start with a quote by the veteran reporter John Lawton, who said, "The irony of the information age is it gives new credibility to uninformed opinion." And I think, in a way, that is one of the that's the reason why brands are having so much trouble.
And what does he sell for a living? What does he sell for a living?
Formed opinion. Can we stick to Justin's point here? There's too many frivolous interruptions coming in.
Is that that's a fair comment. And it's a fair comment, particularly if you look in the marketing space. I mean, if you look at Technorati and you see who are the top bloggers, I mean, Pew being an exception, most of these people are commentators on commentary. So you're getting a kind of snake eats its own tail where credibility is being given. So, you know, the Guardian media section starts quoting some blog commentator who really, you know, from a practitioner's perspective, is talking bollocks. You know, that's like totally different from our experience of the coalface. Hold on,
okay.
A moment. You can talk a bit later.
Okay.
But I guess the point I'm really trying to make is like, content needs to be seen in that context of this credibility. And I think the real...
User-generated content.
And the real challenge for marketeers, which is why something like MySpace is really interesting, is that idea of trying to kind of identify credibility and influence. Now, if you look at somewhere like MySpace, who can see who are the most connected people within their community, who are the most influential... Then you start to, and this kind of answers Hugh's question, which is, you know, why are all advertising agencies dickheads? Well, it's not because they're dickheads. It's because eyeballs, you know, just going onto another form of media for eyeballs, which is actually harder for them to manage the process of selling it to their clients, et cetera, kind of doesn't move things forward. So what you are beginning to see is brands realizing that actually, what they want to do is create conversations with those most influential of their customers. And therefore, you know, somewhere like MySpace becomes much more important to, say, some bloggers, because you know, bloggers aren't able to see from their audience, like a newspaper, about what, how much of that audience is actually influential in the same way or credible as, say, an environment like MySpace. So I think that's the way you'll see the shifting sands. And you've only, you know, James mentioned Jim Stengel or whatever. I mean, but there you have Procter & Gamble with their Tremor division and voting, where they've recruited 250,000 influential teens and 500,000 influential mums to start conversations. So I think that in a way, if we're going to talk about content, we also need to be talking about influence and credibility.
Absolutely correct. I'm going to ask Nicholas to talk to us about whether brands give a shit about credibility in content.
Doesn't appear to be at the moment. I mean, no.
They don't.
I don't think so.
It's about the buzz, right? Yeah. Or whatever you want to call it.
Actually, do you mind if I just kind of like to reflect on some of the other things
of course
that have happened today?
Of course.
I don't mind answering the question directly. Because I think, well, you know, in the remit of this, you know, this marketing 2.0 piece. Sorry, I think it'd be useful just to take a step back and.
We do need some more volume on that mic.
Consider a couple of things. The first being that we seem to be talking about this medium as something that, you know, and marketing in general is something that's actually nothing to do with the underlying kind of, you know, businesses, brands, products. We kind of think of this thing as, you know, advertising as marketing as something that happens over the top of it in a, you know, disjointed way. But of course that's absolutely not true. You know, brands, products, everything we know is formed as much by the medium as it is by their own internal processes. You know, and obviously marketing research and things like that. So I think one thing that's really important is not to just sort of think, okay, you know, we're a company, we're doing a certain thing, how are we going to kind of engage this new medium? It needs to be deeper than that. Or, it's going to take people deeper than that, because the real effect of network media is that the actual brands and the products on sale, the way they're distributed, the way they're talked about and marketed, it completely changes. So the products themselves change.
So how would you advise? How do you advise people on that? I mean,
products.
Well, look,
when you say go deeper, where are they going to if they're taking your advice?
Well, I think they go down to product level. I mean,
experience level.
I mean, it's come from this kind of idea. This is my own kind of reading of it, but I see that, you know, this idea of the golden age of advertising, when product differentiation actually wasn't the issue anymore. It became it's much more about telling emotional stories, creating kind of emotional connections to brands, and was an actual a license to just go off and forget all about, you know, actual product performance. And then yet we're in a moment now where, you know, you do something wrong, you put a foot out of place, and everybody knows about it overnight. It's a tremendous threat. But it does mean that if you're engineering products and brands in a way that's very suited to that kind of environment, then it's a completely different story. This isn't a new thing. I mean, you look at things like Firefox, Flickr, Google to a certain extent as well. I know they're all kind of tech products, so you expect them to be leading in this area. But I mean, they're all things that have come about through word of mouth.
So what you're actually saying is communications coming out of micromedia activities are actually steering the way products and services are developed.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. That's a crucial point.
Well, I would also add, I agree with you. I mean, I would also add that. I'm sitting up here. MySpace does no traditional marketing, and our company is incredibly product-focused.
Exactly. And then, you know, things like, you know, we might not think of you know, music and bands as brands and products, but of course they are.
I didn't address that, by the way, in what you were saying about the opposite, how you can boil up from a conversation and then break into another environment. I mean, the bands and filmmakers and creators on MySpace, I think, are a great example of...
Yeah, there was something kind of interesting that happened with Stormhook when we first started putting the line out there in the blogosphere. He said, "Well, if it works, great. What if it doesn't?" Said, "Well, it'll kill your brand dead overnight. But look on the bright side: if they kill it dead, it's because you have a shit product, and at least you won't spend the next 10 years trying to keep a shit product alive. You can move on really quickly." And he went, "Oh, that's a good idea." You can't do that if you have shareholders. Shareholders are collectively amoral. They just care. They just want to see the stock price go up. And the, you know, brands owned by publicly traded companies. And what I was trying to, the thing is, brands, the big brands, anyways, they can't do that because they have shareholders. And basically their paymasters are amoral.
Okay, that's a good point. I want to get back to Nicholas now, and then we're going to start having some questions from the floor. Thank you for your patience.
I think that's a really important point. I think just, I think it's back to the point earlier about how it's horribly kind of undervalued. Yeah, if you put all these things together, you realise that actually that's a tremendous opportunity. And some of the things we've been, some of the ways we've been talking about things today already makes me feel a bit like, the threat is this kind of anarchy, or the threat is about the rules being drawn up without business being a part of it. And actually, the threat isn't anarchy and this other thing. The threat is, the business threat is business. The business threat are smarter, cooler, more connected, more switched on products that are built for this network environment, that are friendly to community interaction. That's the real threat, and that will that'll happen very quickly. We've seen we've seen AdWords turn from a relatively peripheral issue to an overvalued actually issue. Media as soon as people have kind of cottoned on to the power of contextual, really sort of powerful contextual marketing, and I think we'll see the same thing happen. So the question is not, shouldn't we all be jumping on this thing? That's probably not right. It's a great business opportunity for the smart people who are switched on, who can move faster.
But the challenge to the organisation surely then just drops down and goes deeper, does it not?
Absolutely.
It means that you go down from the advertising issue to the marketing issue to the raison d'etre of the business itself. Now, that's really scary for shareholders. Let me pass the mic over to our friend here. You had a question.
Two questions. One is for Hugh, the other is for James. So for Hugh, we talked about the personification of brands earlier, and you mentioned Scoble. Mm-hmm. My question is, do you think Microsoft has created a new brand called Scoble, and what does that mean? And then my second question, so you guys can talk it through, was over to James. So you mentioned the Nike site where you could only select Nike players. It made it sound like you didn't think it was a good idea for them not to be able to select players that were sponsored by Adidas, for example. And if that's the case, why would you advise Nike to open up? And what's in it for them to do that?
For the time being, yes, Microsoft has created or has helped co-create a brand called Scoble, which can leave them at any time as soon as Scoble gets bored of Microsoft. I think I know how much he earns, and it's the amount he earns is surprisingly low considering how much goodwill he injects into the company. The other thing I do know is a lot of people in Microsoft have tried to get him fired. Like I said earlier, blogging when done right is really disruptive, and the only thing that keeps him employed is he's being protected very high up from somebody who desperately or desires change.
So I work for Microsoft, and I can tell you firsthand that there are those that love him and those that hate him, and that he is a polarizing effect inside of Microsoft.
But the thing is, somebody like Steve Ballmer, he wanted certain constituents, fiefdoms within Microsoft to hate him, because he wanted to shake things up.
Can I get Shell to wrap this particular red herring for us, please?
Red herring.
That's off topic.
It's becoming one.
He's the biggest thing to happen in blogging at Microsoft. The biggest thing to happen in business in the last 10 years, and I'm just surprised he's not amazingly famous by now.
Yeah.
First of all, I'm among those that tried to get Scoble fired because I could have made a bundle if he did while we were writing the book. But separately, I think what's interesting is there's an emerging new brand called Scoble, and it's a personal brand. And someday, Robert may or may not leave Microsoft. And when he does, his personal brand will move with him. It'll change as Dan Gilmore's personal brand changed when he left the Mercury. But right now, what has dramatically changed at Microsoft is that its brand is made up not just of Scoble, but of several thousand, 2,500 individuals with varying strengths of personal brand. And when you perceive of Microsoft, the old brand, which was looked upon as the Borg, the evil empire, has disintegrated as a more human brand has evolved. And I think that, first of all, I just ruined my whole debate, but that to me is the most important single point, is that we have brands now. Everybody in this room has a brand now, and our employers or our clients or whatever are affected by the personal brands that go in and out of there.
That seems to me to also touch back, Shell, in a way to Nicholas's point earlier about the deep impact of these communication technologies. Let's not get stuck in advertising and marketing. Let's look at culture as well. Did you have a second question?
And it was the Nike question to James.
Yeah, I mentioned the Nike jogger or yoga type, because I think it just illustrates the problems quite well that a massive brand has. So they've done absolutely everything right, but at the end they couldn't help themselves but control, you know, the message. And that's entirely understandable, because if you've done that for 50 years or so, then it's understandable that it should come out. The problem is that it makes it boring. You know, I'm a pretty keen football fan, so as a result, I go to somewhere, I've got a blog on MySpace where I talk about football, but the most entertaining blog for me is called Arse Blog. Are there any Arsenal fans in the room? Sorry. Anyone know Arse Blog? There we go. I mean, I'm amazed at the number of people, I talk to Arsenal fans, they all know Arse Blog. He's like a hero within this sort of community. So, and just very quickly, the other thing I'd say is that I think... by giving up control, it seems you gain influence. That seems to be one of the things that is emerging. Who came across the Chevy Tahoe business? Okay, for those that don't know, in the States, General Motors set up this competition where consumers could come and make their own adverts about Chevy Tahoe, which is like a big gas guzzler. A number of people came on and criticised it for environmental reasons, you know, quite vocally. And there was a huge backlash of people, you know, General Motors saying, my God, how can they do this? You know, they must be crazy over there to let people talk about their products in this way. Well, they stuck to their guns, and it seemed to me they gained a lot of influence from that, because if a conversation a brand is having is going to be interesting, then of course it has to have people in there who disagree. And I don't think the fact that Chevy Tahoe was a gas guzzler was really news to anyone. And it might have made those people who like gas-guzzling vehicles like it even more.
So once again, the most interesting communications are inbound to the corporation rather than outbound, and the most important brand messages are the exchanges between consumers rather than exchanges between outbound corporation to consumer. We have two very patient gentlemen in the back there. Sir, you first, and then my friend on the left there.
Hello. Actually, it's sort of more of an answer to a question that was asked earlier on, but I want to ask a question to the audience first. How many people have actually tried to sell a program like this to a brand, to any brand? So, you know, who work in agencies have actually tried to do it. How many of them have actually been successful? Yeah, cool. How many people would like to sell these sort of programs to brands? My name's John Baines, I work at Lateral, and we work with Levi's, and last year we hello, Ivan. And last year we actually pulled off a thing called Antidote, which was, you know, this kind of thing, and what we've discovered is the big question which you asked earlier on, which nobody's actually answered, is why aren't people putting more money into these kinds of programs? Why is it 0.01% of...
No.
Okay, I'm just going to present a suggestion of what an answer might be from past experience.
Okay, I'm going to take that as a contributing question. There's a guy over there in that row, and I'd like to combine these two questions if we could, because we're running short on time. Was that an answer or a question?
But actually, all I want to say is the problem that I've certainly experienced is it actually comes from the nature of campaign, the word campaign. People think about these things in very short term. And that's one. Number two is actually the lack of creative in inverted commas, is that most big ad agencies don't actually want to support this kind of thing, because actually they don't have big ads to make, you know, because you're letting the communities make it for themselves. Number three is media. It's actually a pain in the ass to buy the media, you know, to actually go into the blogs and actually, you know, and there's no accreditation in any way, shape, or form. There's no collective responsibility, to actually say, okay, we're going to take this mass of blogs, that we can take blogosphere and make it safe. Incredible.
Check out Federated Media.
Wasn't there hold on a second. Wasn't there a blog agency, an agency specifically for blogging that got set up in New York a while back? Has that not started to... So people are obviously starting to address the media buying issue here. Okay, I think that's a very broad question that will hopefully be answered over the next 20 minutes. This guy over here has been waiting with extraordinary patience. And we'll get over here in a second, guys. Okay, be patient. Be even more patient.
I've been having a number of conversations with different people in media, and all of them want to jump in and actually have user-generated content on their sites. So everyone from Sky, and BBC, we have lots of different kind of conversations. But one of the big things that keeps coming up is accountability, especially with what happens when somebody says something disparaging about a competitor on the site or makes a comment about a celebrity on a Sky portal. Now, obviously MySpace is going to have some of these issues as well when people start to say or do things which are a bit outside the scope of what they should be doing. But I'd like to know what all you think about how to actually be accountable and how to get the brands to take that step forward and accept that there's going to be this kind of feedback.
I'd like to get Jamie, you want to just have you got a thought on that one? About the accountability issue of advertising?
Yeah, I mean, I think brands already are thinking about that. I mean, I don't think that they're not thinking about that already. I don't know, the way you address your question makes it sound like nobody's really engaged in this already. But, I mean, specifically on MySpace, as I addressed earlier, we will monitor a brand programming community for a certain period of time after it's put up on MySpace with certain, specifications of the advertiser, and then it's the advertiser's responsibility after, if they want to keep their MySpace community up after their flight is over, to monitor the content that's being posted on the site. But that's a specific question. I mean, I think that it depends on how you're inserting your brand. I mean, you can add tools to a profile or to a blog or a community that allows for more conversation. You can add, like we were talking about, user-generated content, using content as marketing is not necessarily about writing something. It might be about publishing something. It might be about creating a piece of content. I mean, it might not necessarily be about dialogue, conversation between two people. So I think that it's really going to be up to the brand.
Is this not really a question about the nature of media value in social networks rather than accountability? Its question is not so much what can we measure, but why are we measuring it and what are we measuring it for? Alan, you have any thoughts on that quickly? Yeah, get a microphone down front here.
It's interesting, the debate here in terms of my experience, both from sort of talking to clients on the one hand and advertising agencies in the other, but there seems to me a huge gap in terms of education. And actually a willingness to actually want to dive in and actually really think about what these things mean. Why are people communicating? What is the explosion of peer-to-peer communication? Which is actually the real revolution of what we're looking at here.
So what's happening to the brand?
What's happening to the brand, and actually what we need to do as a client, need to understand what the language is and why these things are happening. And what you get is a real sort of... I mean, I think the debate has certainly started over the last 6 months. Whereas last year they sort of understood that there was a separation between convergence or mobile or blogging or whatever. This year there seems to be a much bigger pull on that. But also back to the advertising agencies, I know two CEOs of two large companies which actually are really struggling with the paradigm shift that they're being faced with, but also within their own organisation. So it's back to the disruption in the organisation is you've got to get the organisations to start thinking differently, otherwise you'll never do anything differently.
Right. And let me just add one more thing about the accountability, which I didn't mention. And I think that this goes for blogs. It certainly goes for a connected community because you have a lot more people who are networked with one another. But people are putting their lives online and they're creating identities online. And they, you have to respect that these communities are self-policing to a certain extent. Now, not at all meant to criticize blogs. Blogs are a little bit more of a microcosm because you usually have a blogger with one voice who then comments. And so you may get a different type of nature of that on the self-policing standpoint. But in a community like MySpace, you can talk about inserting whether it's music or a brand into the community, but the best rises to the top. And the and so that's one point about a brand. But the other thing is that people aren't about to go onto a website if they're, you know, most people, and make themselves, you know, seem like a bully. Or, I mean, there are issues with cyberbullying and abuse on the web, but it's such a small percentage of people. And I know it's a good thing to address when we talk to marketers about what potentially could happen on their site, because people have their identities. It's who they are online. And so, you know, most people don't want to seem like the person on that community that's actually, you know, being the negative space there. So I think that we should also put credit to user-generated policing in these user, you know, world of user-generated content.
Okay, more questions from the floor. We had a... Yes, sir, over there. Can you get the mic back to my colleague in the 1-2-6th row? Anyone else got questions, by the way, just so I know where you are? Oh, my God. Okay, we'll get to you.
It's more of a question about the sort of the effect of mainstream media compared to the sort of the social decentralized media that you're talking about. There's a chap in the front row who mentioned this sort of word of mouth advertising and this sort of MySpace advertising, and mentioned Firefox, but Firefox took out massive full-page adverts in the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal and all of these sorts of things. Yeah, all the money they got from Google from putting their search bar.
So it was a community spend.
Sort of, yeah. But the
okay, okay. One
but Firefox, it's almost like buying a political advertisement.
Okay, so what's your point, sir? What's your point?
Okay, well, just quickly, sort of the biggest myth last year about this sort of internet advertising marketing thing was the Arctic Monkeys. But they sold 1 million records because every commercial radio station played their catchy song 10 times a day. And there was nothing really on the web. But then there were all of these stories about them being on the web, but there wasn't. There was just this chat about them being on the web when they weren't actually doing anything. So my point is, to get mainstream results, you need to have mainstream media.
I think, actually, there is a bigger point. I take your point. I think the Arctic Monkeys thing is probably a bit weary, and we should take a vote to put it down as of today. I think one of the most interesting points is, how do you get mainstream media value into a social media environment? That really is the question that's exercising people's minds.
I don't think anyone's saying it's one or the other. I mean, you have your tradition. Like I was mentioning before, you're going to always have all of your traditional media. New media is not about to kill traditional media. Just going to become... I don't think so. I mean, I think that it just becomes another platform, and what we've been discussing is the internet is the verifier. It's the information resource for people at their fingertips, and you have to...
Jamie, there is actually a point that we need to make. There is a general exodus, a mental exodus, if you want, among marketers that use traditional linear media for brand exposure at the moment. They are worried about television. All of those issues that we've been aware of, fragmentation, are all very, very big. So I think the fact of the matter is some of these people may well be driven into thinking about alternative outlets for the brand because of the what they feel is a crisis in, for example, print or TV.
Oh, definitely. I mean, it's becoming more segmented, obviously, and people have to adjust their marketing and, like, again, go back to the product. I mean, you need to adjust your company for a changing face in technology. But
the trouble with there's nothing wrong with advertising except for two things. One is that it's really rude and obnoxious. Okay, it's, you know, you have a nice time watching, you know, Friends or Seinfeld or whatever, and then along comes this asshole trying to sell you insurance, and he's loud and he's noisy, and that happens a lot. And okay, the second thing is, it's bloody expensive. I know this because I used to work in a large advertising agency where really highly paid people did nothing except for go to meetings. That's what they did. A few guys would hit a ball out of a park now and then, but most of the time, we were a complete waste of space.
Okay, I'm sorry. All right,
paying for that.
Okay, that's a well-known phenomenon, by the way.
Yes.
Craig. Don't feel you have to answer that point, by the way.
There's a lot of discussion being around the new generation an observation as an agency working in the field at the moment, working with a number of big brands like Disney and Xbox, is the level of confusion that exists with the clients that we're working with. I just want to ask an open question to anybody on the panel or in the room, whether we as an industry are making this as easy as we could for the people that we're referring to as them, they don't get it. Are there things we can be doing to make the work that could be done in marketing with these audiences simpler? Is it around education? Is it around explaining the actual revenue models that could be simplified? Any thoughts around that area?
Well, let me rephrase that slightly for Greg. What is going on out there that you think is moving forward client insight in this area? Is anyone aware of organizations, initiatives, including, by the way, New Media Knowledge, that's making it easier to understand the impact on return on investment
teenagers.
For a brand?
Teenagers are basically the education right now.
I don't think the agencies want to know what's happening. I think the PR industries have been much more proactive about finding this.
I don't think that's completely true. The problem is
Justin.
They haven't found a measure or a metric yet that they feel comfortable.
That's true, yeah.
And so, you know, it's got to get beyond. I mean, everyone realizes, but
A measurement they feel comfortable with that they can make a profit on.
They're in business. But it's. I think the problem is that everyone's aware that brand awareness just doesn't necessarily equal sales. So, you know, other people are touting other metrics, whether it's engagement, which I'm not completely certain proves anything other than someone engages with a brand, or advocacy is another thing that Bain & Co. with their Net Promoter Score are using. And I think it's those kind of things which will actually help those brands and their advertising agencies feel more comfortable. Because if you can't manage what you can't measure, so they need some measurement.
Can I make the point that measurements across all forms of marketing and marketing communications have always been pretty flaky, and the internet is actually no exception to that.
But people have bums they need to cover, so they want, if they're going to spend money, they want to make sure that they're...
Maybe that's the point. Hold on. I want to get some more questions from the floor. We've only got about 8 minutes of this session left, so I want to make sure we get some more from the floor. Mark, in a second. Gentleman in the third from back row. Yes, sir.
I'll start by making an observation. At the Web 2.0 conference last year in the States, there was about four advertising agencies there. You had a Google keynote speech from Terry Semel. Sergey Brin, there were four ad agencies, 2,000 people. At the Changing Media Conference, The Guardian did, I think there were three. Here there's maybe two traditional ad agencies. I haven't really looked very deeply, but there's something interesting about that.
Those guys.
The question I'd put is, isn't the problem that the effect of a campaign that you do through connected media or viral or anything like this, there can be just such a vast difference in the results of a campaign, and it's actually very, very difficult. So when you're going to brands and you're going to ad agencies and you're asking them for money to invest in the impact, then the problem is at that point you really can't control it, and it really is a leap of faith for them.
That's a great thing, though.
Not for them.
It works.
Okay, Sam.
Why agencies don't target his own brand itself, Gaping Void. I suppose if a traditional agency was sat down with a brand saying, I want to target these consumers, what would the agency say to them, and would Gaping Void come up in their list? And who's your audience, therefore, that you're addressing for a brand to reach? My point being, I love your site, and a lot of people here do, but I read it for humour, not because I'm trying to read it as a brand consumer or a marketeer trying to reach the audience. I don't know who your audience is.
People like you. You know.
Yes, sir. Back. And then Mark. And I think we're getting close to wrap. Can we get a mic over to the back corner there? Network it across.
I just want to make a comment about the title of this debate and how it expresses the horns of dilemma which some people seem to be on, which is, I think content 2.0 means, shall we say, popularly generated content, and in which case does marketing 2.0 mean popularly generated marketing. In other words, what matters is what people say, and the question that people seem to be answering is how can we influence what they say? That's the dilemma that the brands seem to have.
Hold on. I don't think we're actually asking. I think a range of questions around that subject are being asked. I think the control issue is obviously critical. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's not necessarily a control issue, but if that's what marketing 2.0 is, it's about other people talking about your products. If then there's two answers to that. One is subterfuge and embellishment, and the other one is truth. And if it's the latter, then it goes back to the point that Nick made originally about the product. And the whole idea in terms of the industry and how that moves forward is that the marketing manager and the product manager are no longer necessarily separate roles.
So this takes us back yet again to the impact way below advertising and marketing on the way the organization itself behaves.
Absolutely.
Particularly with the emphasis on transparency and a slightly more profound type of accountability, I'd argue. Mark. You don't need a mic, right? So.
Witnessing what Jamie and MySpace is going through is very educational for all of us, because it says that regardless of whether it's old media or new media, that, for instance, traditional conservative brands don't want to be associated with soft porn, and other kind of risque people want to be associated with soft porn and not with boring traditional sites. And so that really says that all those morals translate very well into the new economy. But at the same time, I'm fascinated with the deals that Fox has been cutting with their affiliate television networks, which they're agreeing to share revenues because they're recognizing the value chain and the realities of their business models. And so that in a lot of ways, MySpace is simply there to prop up the Fox network is part of this kind of synergistic thing, which we've all known was coming, but you know, no one else has ever really executed very well on synergy. And there's Fox, you know, they bought the football rights at a huge loss, which gave birth to their television network. And so they've been able to parlay that, and for them to recognize the realities of how MySpace would affect their affiliate relationship to their television networks and share the revenues. I mean, to me, that's really cutting edge in what's up.
It speaks to me of a much more sophisticated attitude towards attention and where it's going and the value of it. Last question, sir. There's a microphone here for you.
Mike Butcher, journalist on mbytes.com. That's my brand and I'm sticking to it. I'm just wondering if the panel has any thoughts about, on the one side, marketing to these sort of psyched out social networks, which it just seems to me like very, very big niche and not really hugely mainstream. I'm reminded of the quote about the last thing I want to do when I get home is interact with anything other than the fridge. And the mainstream audience really largely don't really care that much. They want to watch Coronation Street and they want to maybe I'm being a bit dismissive, but I would say that's quite a general view. And so I got on the one hand, you've got a big niche of people who actually want to create content, network online, that kind of thing. Maybe it's a new generation, not my generation, it's younger, maybe. And then you've, on the other hand, you've got people who don't really give a damn either way. But rather interestingly, when the 7/7 happened last year in London, the BBC guys here who can talk about it more, about how, you know, they received 3,000 text messages and they received 300 mobile videos or pictures, and they're creating content. That is a mainstream event and a mainstream content creation event. And it's not something that MySpace, I think, or that kind of ilk would necessarily sort of speak to at the moment, but maybe it will change.
There's a number of questions there, actually. Jamie, would you like to? This will be the last answer from the panel.
A couple of points to that. One, I agree with you. It probably is more of a large niche. It just happens to be a demographic of people who advertisers constantly want to reach and who are increasingly more elusive, and they're just online. I definitely agree with you, depending on your life habits. Yes, maybe you're not going home and getting on a place like MySpace and spending an hour and a half searching through a bunch of personal profiles, but there are great examples of how social networks are used to be engaged in world phenomena. On MySpace, for example, just one example, is when the tsunami happened, there was a group that formed overnight of over 20,000 people who leveraged the group to search for loved ones in Thailand. So, you know, forget what MySpace might mean as an everyday brand to, you know, the elusive 18-year-old that Xbox might not know how to otherwise reach. but it has a huge impact on social empowerment, not just MySpace, but any type of communication tool like that. And I think for us, more and more, we're seeing the site being used for a lot more world and civic happenings. And it truly, when you have that many people on a website, it truly does become a true reflection of all aspects of life online. And so maybe those people aren't the people who are power users or who are, you know, wasting time at, you know, during class surfing through the web. But certainly there's a huge power in these types of communication tools that I think we're seeing, you know, in the BBC or in the MySpace or anything like that.
Thank you, Jamie. Ladies and gentlemen, it's 11:45, which means that we need to wrap. First of all, can I ask you to give it up for our panelists, who are James, Hugh, and Jamie. For those of you who didn't